This is Let's Go Michigan with Jeff Sloan on 760 WJR. Your bird's eye view on Michigan's business and entertainment scene. Here's Jeff.
All right, welcome to Let's Go Michigan on this great weekend. Kristen Kajawa, Mark Pastoria joining me, of course, to co-host the show. Guys, welcome. Good to have you.
Nice to be here again.
Yeah, absolutely.
We had a little hiatus last week.
We did. We were preempted by
Spartans football.
The Spartans football. And it was a win.
We'll take it.
How about that? Yeah, we're happy to be preempted as long as they get the win, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And those are few and far to come by
these days.
But we'll take it. Hopefully today will fare as well for the Sparties and the Wolverines as well, of course. All right, listen, guys, to kick things off, there's no bigger story really in news. There are other really important stories, of course, but really nothing bigger than what the impact of AI is having on both business and our personal lives as well. Sam Altman, the founder and CEO of OpenAI, has just introduced the latest version, that version 4, I believe it is. He's calling it something like ChatGPT Turbo. That coming out, got further enhancements to the capability associated with the AI technology. And boy, guys, it continues to grow in capability at breakneck speed. You're seeing life-changing, life-altering, business-changing technology that's going to create sweeping change in many ways. Many would argue, of course, and it's true, that it's going to create positive change in productivity and the way you operate your business more effectively and all the rest. But it's also really scary. There's no getting away from it. As AI becomes more capable, it begs questions like, what's the ultimate impact on humans? Are there threats and so on? Well, listen, Sam Altman himself has an opinion on this. The guy that's just announced a even better, more glorified, turbocharged AI capability warns us that AI is now capable of learning superhuman persuasion. He says humanity is still a long way away from building artificial intelligence or an AI that matches the cognitive function of humans. As he puts it, if, of course, we're ever actually able to do so. Nonetheless, he goes on, though, to warn whether or not a future like that comes to pass, AI doesn't have to be what's known as AGI level smart. That has to do with general information gathering capability, general decision-making capability, in order to take control of the feeble minds of human beings. I expect AI, he says, to be capable of superhuman persuasion well before it is superhuman at general intelligence. He just tweeted that out this past week. And that may lead to, as he put it, some very strange outcomes. Well, duh.
I'm actually, as you're talking, I'm thinking about how my kids are going to use that.
Yeah, your kids are going to use it. They're going to use it against you.
That's exactly what I'm thinking. Like, they are also already very persuasive. Now you throw in ChatGPT Turbo. Oh, I'm going to be out of luck here.
Well, ChatGPT Turbo is nothing compared to what's to come. He goes on to say, while Altman didn't elaborate on what these specific outcomes might be, it's not a far-fetched prediction, so say those who are experts in the matter. User-facing AI chatbots like OpenAI's ChatGPT are designed to be good conversationalists, and as they put it, have become eerily capable of sounding convincing, even if they're entirely incorrect about something.
Oh, boy.
I see trouble on the horizon. At the same time, it's also true that humans are already beginning to form emotional connections to various AI-driven chatbots. And that, of course, makes them sound even more convincing because you've got this emotional connection. There's a certain basis of trust and connection and all the rest underlying everything. The ChatGPT tells you that you can fly. Let me give that a try.
Oh my gosh.
Right.
Oh no. I feel like there is a movie based on this already.
Oh, there's got to be movies in the works. That's for sure. But listen, you know, we teed this up by saying this is a major sea change as it comes to our human existence and what this might mean in the future. And I'll tell you this. The cat's out of the bag, guys. I mean, it's happening right under our nose. It's happening. There are for-profit motives now driving this, of course. There are many, many benefits that are real and tangible associated with this. People are adopting it. People are using it. They're getting good at it. And of course, those companies who are developing it are getting good at making it even better. And as Sam Altman himself warns us, look out, could have superpowers that are going to be able to drive superhuman persuasion.
So what you're saying is Alexa and Siri are like old news.
Oh, That's
so last year.
Basically, Alexa and Siri will respond to you and give you information. That is a form of AI, no doubt, but that is the most, you know, primitive.
Primitive, yeah. They better step up their game.
Well, guys, let's change the subject here, getting away from our concerns about all of this AI technology coming at us and its impending impact on the human species. Let's talk about our weather this winter and that old El Nino that's forecast to hit us. What does it mean? Let me first ask you each. You guys like winter. I mean, we do it. We like winter, right? There's a novelty to it. There's winter sports. Right. You like winter.
Yeah.
Do you like the cold weather associated with winter, or what is it about winter that you like?
I like the cold weather because then that at times indicates it's going to snow, and I actually like snow.
Okay, so I would say that you said exactly what I would say as well, and that is this. It's not the cold weather that we love. It's the snow, right?
It's
the novelty. It's the ability to have those winter sports, which rely on snow falling and being on the ground and accumulating and so on. It's not the fact that the temperature is so low.
No.
Right? The temperature needs to be so low, as you put it properly, in order for us to have the snow, and that's what we're all after. Well, I've got bad news for you. There's a chance that we could see some cold weather this winter, even perhaps in at certain times during the winter, some colder weather, but likely less snow.
Oh, boy.
That's the worst possible combination. Now, generally, I will tell you, generally, the El Nino should create generally higher temperatures across the winter season, but there could be pockets of really, really cold weather patterns coming down from the north combined with limited precipitation.
Well, but that's what my ski resort has their snow machines for.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, we're going to be relying. I'm going to tell you, the ski resorts this year in Michigan are probably going to rely heavily, given this forecast, on those snow machines. All right, and then lastly, I want to cover a really great story. Northwood University, of course, located, I believe, in Midland. Look, everybody's got to be famous for something. And now they're famous for something else that is a major emerging program at Northwood University and, frankly, at other colleges around the country, and that is programs in esports.
Yeah, it is a whole program.
So esports, do you know what esports is? That's essentially where kids play these games, you know, mobile games, video games, against one another, and the team that scores the most points wins. And there are now college programs, just like there's sports that rely on more, let's just say, physicality, not to say this doesn't have some degree of physicality associated with it, it does, but this is now a sport. Colleges have teams and colleges compete against one another. And now Northwood's team has added to its trophy case, winning the national championship. That the 2023 Red Bull Collegiate Valorant National Championship in Chicago held just last week. Congratulations to Northwoods University. They're now the national champions in esports. How cool is that?
Is it really a sport, though, or is it a club?
Well, you know, as we know, like, for example, all the new sports being added to the Olympics. I know flag football. I know some sort of dancing is going to be added to the Olympics. So the definition of sports is expanding greatly.
Got it.
I think at the heart of sports is competition.
Right.
And I think what you're really driving at is it physical enough to be considered sports. And I think that has merit. I mean, sports really are, as we know them traditionally, dependent heavily on one's physical prowess in one way or another. You know, whether it's skiing, whether it's rowing, whether it's football, basketball, whatever it may be, there's a certain degree of supreme physicality required in order to be good. This may be less so, but much like, for example, driving a racing car is a sport.
That's a good point. Okay.
I think this is too. You know, by the way, many would say that it requires tremendous physical capability to drive a race car because of the endurance required and the ability to stay focused, the stamina, and all the rest. The same is true here. These kids are having to play against one another in a competitive environment, and they do have to be able to be physically capable enough to have the stamina and endurance to get through these games, do it faster and better than anybody else.
Cool.
Got an esports champion right here in the state of Michigan. Again, congratulations to Northwoods University. So, there you have it. Listen, guys, Mark, you've already done it. You've gotten through it successfully. I'm in the process of doing it. Kristen, you're going to be doing it in a few years. What we're talking about is sending our kids to college and paying their tuition.
I have my paper and pencil all ready to go to take notes.
On the next interview.
On our next interview. I'm ready.
So what you're referring to is that we've got news. We're covering a story that, in fact, when you see a published college tuition amount that they've referenced, that is the cost of going to a particular college or university, that may not be the case, but it's incumbent upon you to know how to find out, well, what do I need to pay and how you can work it to figure out how and what to pay.
It's almost like the idea of the sticker price on a car, right?
Oh.
I mean, is it really the price? Can I haggle it down?
Well, here's the thing, though. When you go in to buy a car, you kind of expect that that's, you know, you've got to get yourself all in the right mindset right. and everything. You've got to negotiate. You don't think of that when you're going to pay a college tuition. But listen, we've got James Murphy, Deputy Director of Higher Education Policy at Education Reform Now. He's here to tell us, buyer beware, caveat emptor, the great college pricing sham is a reality. James, tell us what's going on here. Is, in fact, the college tuition amount indicated by a college the amount you've got to pay at a high level? What's this all about? You say no.
Yeah, so the story is that figuring out how much to pay for college or how much you should pay for college is immensely difficult in America. One of the reasons for that is the way that we've decided to set up college in the United States, which is that it's mostly treated as something individuals pay for to get an individual benefit, even though there's clear indications that the benefits of people going on to college are for the broader society. Meaning that when we have a more educated populace, mm-hmm. right, people prepared to do high-level work, that benefit comes in the form of both taxes, right? So taxes that go to states and to localities and to the federal government, but it also comes with all the benefits of having higher education. Your children are better educated as a result. Your health is better as a result. There's been really great and sort of shocking research on who COVID hurt or who the opioid epidemic has hurt. And it redoundingly falls on the heads of people who do not have college education. So there's broad benefits to higher education, but the way it's priced right now is both deeply confusing and it is, let's face it, expensive.
So let's talk about that. How is it priced right now? Break it down for us.
Yeah. So I think the very first thing we need to talk about when we're talking about how much college costs is that there's really three things we have to consider. There is the sticker price of college, right? So what happens when you look at the website and it tells you what the price is? And this is where you see the numbers like $70,000, $80,000 right. a year.
Yep.
Then there's something called net price, which is actually just simply like what people actually pay. So what do they pay after they get grants from the government and increasingly discounts from colleges in the form of merit aid? So that's a second component here. And then the third component, the trickiest one for everybody to figure out, is what it costs for a university to educate a student every single year. And so there's good news on many of those fronts, right? Recent data that came out from the College Board shows that both the sticker price, but more importantly, that net price, the price people actually pay, has, when you adjust for inflation, actually gone down in recent years. It was actually more expensive using inflation-adjusted prices to go to college in 2006 than in 2022. But the reality is it's still very expensive. So, you know, paying $20,000 for everything for, you know, say a public college in North Carolina, and I'm talking about books, housing, tuition fees, and everything like that, $20,000 is still a huge amount of money for many, many families, right? It's better than $50,000, which might be the sticker price that they think that they're going to have to pay, but $20,000 is still a lot of money.
Yeah, and of course, there's the price of a great education. Then there's paying to help your child have an on-ramp to a better earning capability down the road that helps justify the spend as well. Both of those things are important to parents, of course, and to the student. And that's kind of what you get in exchange for the price that you pay. Where does the great pricing sham happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think the sham part of it is that people don't know how much college is going to cost. So that's one. So how many things in life do you have to wait until the very last moment to find out the price? There are restaurants where sometimes you open the menu and there are no prices and you just feel like, oh my God, this is going to be incredibly expensive, is what that tells you. With college, you don't actually know how much you're going to end up paying until way deep into the process, after you've been admitted and then they put together a financial aid practice. So part of the sham is that you just simply don't know how much it's going to cost. And what it costs you might not be as much as what it costs somebody from an area like the state where the college doesn't need as many students, right? So the level of discounting that private colleges do is based on a whole range of factors that are completely opaque and people don't know about. So that's, I think, sham one. Sham two is this idea that we can maintain this situation in which the prices of college do keep going up every single year, students are told they need to go to college in order to get a good job. And there's some truth to that. And yet nothing is really being done to address the price of college. Nothing is being done to drive the price of college down, which is where we get into the situation of debt forgiveness. And millennials in particular feel like they've been sold a bill of goods. Go to college, get a good job, and you know, take out some debt. It's not a problem. But you have students now with $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 worth of debt, and they feel like they haven't gotten that return on the investment.
Yeah, and I see a couple of problems there. One, I'm just amazed that the price to go to a college, any given college, may or may not be necessarily the price that you ultimately pay. You tend to believe that this is not, you know, a used car sales lot or anything, you know, or an airline ticket you're trying to buy where, you know, so-and-so's paying this price and you're paying that price and so on. You would think that the price would be the price, except for, of course, if you're able to qualify for any kind of aid or assistance in any way. And that's a different thing, but still, it's all driven off the same retail price, if you will. Just for clarity, is that not the case?
No. So the vast majority of people will not pay the sticker price for college.
That's unbelievable. I never knew that.
The people who do are typically very wealthy, right? So like, you know, to bring up the college that everybody has to talk about at some point when you talk about college, at Harvard, the sticker price is about $80,000. But the average price of for people who take out any kind of federal loan or get a federal grant is, I think, about $18,000. Now, there are a lot of people going to Harvard who will pay that full sticker price. And in, to some degree, what they're paying helps subsidize the financial aid for people who can't afford it. But once you get into the realm of most private universities and many state universities as well, they're providing a whole range of discounts. They're called merit aid. They're often called scholarships. When people get them, they feel like, oh, that you really, really want me. You're really interested in me. You think I'm super smart. But then you dig a little deeper and you find out everybody's getting a merit aid scholarship. Because the trick is, just like you mentioned a store, why do stores give coupons? Not because they like you and they're, you know, they're really interested in you personally. They want you to come and shop there, right?
Sure, of course.
Same thing with undergraduate colleges. They discount the price in order to get you to cough up some money.
Based on what you're telling me, it sounds like if the price is $80,000 a year, one way or the other, the university that's selling the educational service, the opportunity, still gets the $80,000. It's incumbent upon those applying, those ultimately that will go to that school, to be clever enough and resourceful enough to be able to find ways to pay less than $80,000 based on programs they qualify and other opportunities to help that given student ultimately, or the parents of that given student ultimately pay less than that price while the university still gets that price, right? It's not like the university is dropping the price for a given student. This student pays 60, that one pays 70, this one pays 75. It's still $80,000. It's just as a parent or as someone supporting themselves going to school, you've got to be resourceful enough to find ways to pay less based on programs available to you to help you do just that. Is that right?
Not exactly, actually.
Okay. I mean, we need clarification on that.
Yes, yes, yeah.
See? I still need help here.
Yes. Well, part of the problem, of course, is that when we talk about colleges and universities, we often end up talking about just those ones that are the top-ranked colleges in U.S. News rankings, right? So, like, the most famous institutions, which educate not even 10% of students in America. So most students are not going to the kind of place where people are really happy to cough up the full freight for tuition. Most places, the prices they set are kind of a fiction, ultimately, right? So the university is going to say, well, we'll charge $60,000 because we know then that if we can give a $25,000 discount on it, right? Because really what we need to get out of somebody is $35. We'll charge $60, we'll discount it $25 on average for people. Families feel this way. I've seen this, feel like, oh my gosh, we got a scholarship. How can we say no? That's so exciting. And so they'll say like, all right, so we'll pay the $35 because we got this great scholarship. But the university essentially was always aiming for that $35,000 amount. Now, what makes it all unsustainable is that that discounting rate has gotten so widespread and so deep that you're seeing some private institutions, they simply can't pay the bills anymore.
Wow. That's stunning to me that actually one student or parents of a given student might be paying less than somebody else just because the university wanted them for whatever reason and was extending some sort of discount off the price selectively to one student versus another.
Absolutely the case.
That's incredible. That is a sham. Indeed.
And you know, for listeners, the sort of the practical advice to give on this is, first, you know, when you get your financial aid offer from a college, don't treat it like it's the last offer. I mean, you do have to kind of walk into these situations like you're shopping for a car, thinking like, okay, so this is the start of the negotiation. You should not be afraid to reach out to them and say, hey, you know, my daughter's really interested in going to X college, but the price is a little bit high. We've also got this offer from this other place as well. Do you think you can take anything off? You know, some institutions will find the money, some institutions won't, but it's 100% worth trying.
You have enlightened us. This is amazing. Really, it is. Who knew? I certainly didn't. Just sent a kid off to college and paid full price. But you can be sure when the next bill comes around, I'll be making a phone call. Listen, James, thanks so much for, as I say, enlightening us and bringing our awareness to the fact that the published price when it comes to paying for a great college education may not indeed be the price you need to pay.
Exactly.
Appreciate it very much, James. Thanks for being on with us.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate you having me on.
All right, Kristen, so we started this segment by you saying you've got your pencil, I believe it was.
Yeah.
Your pencil. Not your pen, your pencil. Yeah. Out being the good little student that you are.
Yeah.
Did you take notes? Did you learn something?
I did, Jeff. I think it was you and I that were speaking at the beginning of the interview that we kind of expect this sort of thing when it comes to buying a car, but you never really think that this would be the case when it comes to paying for college tuition. But now we know, and I'm definitely going to be ready for what's ahead.
You feel ready. And again, the real bottom line here is that you may not have to pay what you think you have to pay, but again, it's incumbent upon you, the parent, or in this case, me, I'm sending kids to college as well, to be able to understand how the system really works and to work it accordingly. Listen, guys, we know that the state of Michigan has got to have population growth like any other state in order to continue to build its tax base and all the other things that go with people living in a given state, doing their spending in that given state largely, and so on and so on. Critically important to a state's ability to be not only relevant into the future, but viable even. And you look at Michigan, I think it ranks, as I recall through a previous story we've done, 49th of all states, out of all states, in population growth, which is really, really not only unfortunate, but really scary as you think about the future of the state of Michigan. Well, there's a new, let's call it an opportunity available to the state in order to kind of address that problem. It might not be the answer, but it certainly could be part of the answer. And that is attracting remote workers who might want to come to the state of Michigan to live, but work for a company in another state. By living here, they pay their income tax here and they spend their money here because that's where they live. So that is a very, very interesting proposition. Here to tell us all about it, Ron French. He's an associate editor of Bridge Michigan. He's got the story for us. Ron, this is an interesting potential solution for us as it relates to our lack of population growth and an opportunity for maybe to add to the state's population and address the issue of population drain. Ron, welcome to the show. Tee this up for us.
Sure, absolutely. Well, thank you for having me on. As you know, the state's having a worker shortage, and we're just all like pulling our hair out trying to figure out what we can do about it. Well, one of the things that we've run across, and I'm sure a lot of employees have, is that more and more workers are able to work remotely. Not only they were able to work remotely before the pandemic, but that sort of like broke the ice. And now a lot of people don't want to go back to work. Some employers have found that, you know, it's cheaper to have the workers work at home rather than rent all this office space. So you have these thousands and thousands of people just in Michigan who have jobs but can live any place they want as long as there's good Wi-Fi. So we're in this position where these are the types of workers that Michigan wants. You know, they are typically college educated, typically young. And are we as a state going to win more of those people who can live any place they want or lose more of those to other states?
Yeah, and winning these people, for those that don't know, does what for us?
Sure. If I have a job that is based in Colorado, but I live in Michigan, I'm getting my paycheck from Colorado, but I'm not paying Colorado taxes, okay? So the taxes I pay are to Michigan, and I am spending my money here. I'm paying rent or a mortgage. I'm eating at restaurants. I'm probably leasing a car here. So Michigan gets the economic benefit of someone who chooses to live here, even if their job is based in another state. In the same way, Jeff, if Pfizer or if General Motors has an employee that is working remotely in Tennessee, Michigan's not getting any economic benefit from that person.
Right. So really critical. Thanks for framing that out for us. It's important to understand the benefit of having remote workers here in Michigan working for, perhaps, as you put it, a company elsewhere, Tennessee or wherever it may be. What are the key ingredients that we need to have as a state that really will help rather than it being sort of a random choice like my girlfriend's from the state of Michigan, so I'm going to move there to work there because my girlfriend's there. But let's be more proactive about this. What can we do to put ourselves in a better position to win these remote workers versus losing them to other states?
Sure, it's a fascinating question, and it takes a whole reframing of how we've approached economic development. Michigan and most states have looked at economic development as, let's spend a lot of money to get someone to build a factory in a cornfield and workers will show up because workers would go where there were jobs. Well, if you can have a job someplace else but live where you want to live and you want to attract those people, you have to think in terms of not about what incentives do we give to companies, or at least that can't be all of your approach. You have to think about what economic incentives do we have to offer to help communities become more attractive to these people who can live any place they want. You find that people who are that mobile, they tend to be younger remote workers. They want places where there's beautiful nature, there's hiking and biking, where there is a critical mass of people like them. They want a vibrant downtown. So you have to start thinking about how do we make our communities more attractive to someone who can choose to live any place they want.
Yeah, this is a real quality of life issue. Kristen, you were going to jump in.
Oh, I was just going to jump in. Like when you were describing, Ron, those desirable attributes of cities that young people might be attracted to move to Michigan, instantly I thought of Detroit, Grand Rapids, Traverse City. Those seem to fit the bill.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where you're seeing people, particularly in Traverse City and other communities up north. Even Charlevoix is getting some. And Grand Rapids has a very cool downtown, as I'm sure you know. Detroit is attracting people. But there's a way to do it with smaller communities, too, that are at least close to amenities. You'll find that even in a place like Indiana, which people in Michigan may not think is such a cool state to live in, there are older communities with like old-fashioned downtowns within 20, 30 miles of Indianapolis that are completely revamped, that are filled with all these sort of like cool downtown features. So there's some possibilities even outside of the communities you mentioned, Kristen.
And I would imagine just the basic kind of blocking and tackling of all this too is that you've got to have connectivity available to those who, say, for example, might want to live in a small town in northern Michigan or a rural area, whatever it may be. I know the governor has put real focus on making sure that we have broader connectivity available to all here in the state of Michigan. I imagine that's a factor as well. It can't work remotely unless you have high-speed internet.
Yeah, absolutely. Michigan has to look at Wi-Fi as infrastructure just as important as fixing our damn roads, because people have to have that for their jobs, and they're not even going to consider it. The Upper Peninsula, that's a very attractive place, frankly, for people who want to have that kind of lifestyle. And so you've got a place like Marquette, which is also attracting people like this. But some of the other areas might grow more if there was just a really great internet.
Yeah, indeed. So those are the kinds of things that are important. Are we making progress? I mean, are there indications rather than just one-off story here or there? Are we starting to see Michigan as a destiny for those who want to live a great quality of life and yet work remotely?
That's a very good question, Jeff. And I think that's one of the emphases that are being looked at by the Population Commission that Governor Whitmer launched earlier this year. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but they started this ad campaign that's running in other states and in certain municipalities around the country, advertising for Michigan. And those are focused not as much as you would think on come work at our auto plant. It's really focused on quality of life. So that's something that I think you're seeing, that there's being attempts. If you look at the data, though, Jeff and Kristen, I don't think you see it having an impact yet. I think that we are tending to still lose more college graduates than we're gaining.
Yeah.
It's sort of like addiction. You got to realize there's a problem first. I think we now realize there's a problem. We have in the past focused primarily on financial incentives for factories. We may need to look at having more emphasis on making cities more cool.
Making cities more cool to attract the workers, maybe work elsewhere, but pay their taxes. Their income tax goes to the state of Michigan. And as you said, they spend here in the state of Michigan, and that helps the broader economy. We'll take all the little bits and pieces, put it all together, and hopefully we'll see our population trajectory start to turn in our favor with some growth as opposed to the declines we've been seeing. Listen, Ron, thank you very much for being on with us. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a great topic.
Kristen, I've got to ask you, there's news out now just to kick our segment off here, and then we're going to have a focus in this segment on mobile phones. We'll get to that in a minute, our cell phones and how they're impacting our lives. But before we get to that, I have to ask you, People Magazine announced this past week their sexiest man alive. I'm sure you follow it closely.
Why do you go to me instantly? How you're well, not asking Mark?
I'm going to talk to Mark about the sexiest man alive. I think it's obvious.
Well, okay.
You're kind of in the hot seat on
All
this
right.
one.
All right.
Most appropriate to give us commentary. So I have to ask you.
Yeah.
Do you know who it is?
Well, yes, I do.
You do. Of course you do. You were nail-biting all the way right down to the end.
I do know. It came up on my social feeds.
So it's Patrick Dempsey, mm-hmm. the actor who was on that big television hit show, Grey's Anatomy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think his name on the show is actually Dr. McDreamy.
Yeah, see?
I mean.
There you go.
Hello.
I mean, he's been headed toward this great honor for a long time.
Hold on. Is it actually a great honor to be sexiest man alive?
I was somewhat tongue-in-cheek on that. I wasn't being serious.
Okay.
I think there's something definitely to being awarded that title. Could be a feel-good moment in one's life.
Yeah, when you make the cover of a magazine, I think that's fair.
Well, let me ask you this. First of all, what do you think of the choice?
I mean, I think he is dreamy.
So you think he's worthy?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
All right.
I don't know what the criteria is for making sexiest man. Is there a list of criteria?
Kristen, you're going right where I'm going to go, but I don't know what the People Magazine criteria is, but we all want to know what would be appropriate criteria for what makes the sexiest man alive. So we'd like to just tap your wisdom on this for a minute if we may.
Oh, why do you guys do this?
If I were to ask you to put three or so things on your list.
Mm-hmm.
Of what makes either a man or a woman, just what makes someone sexy, what would you say those qualities would be?
Well, if you're going on the cover of a magazine, you have to look good.
Okay.
You have to be appealing. They're not going to put
physically
a schlup
appealing, of course.
On the cover of a magazine.
Right.
But I would say you have to be smart and funny.
Oh, smart and funny. That's interesting.
Yeah.
That has something to do with being sexy?
For me, yes.
Well, we're out, Jeff.
Mark, you were out when we had to look. We couldn't look schlubby. We were out on the first two words.
That's why we're on the radio.
Yeah, right. But listen, in all seriousness, I think that's interesting. So, of course, they have to look good. Now, many people might start and stop there.
Well, that's
just
true.
Gotta
many
look good.
People just
frankly,
look good.
Keep your mouth shut.
Just stand
Even
there
better.
And look pretty.
Right?
Right.
Right. But you answered the question by saying they've got to be smart and funny too. And the reason I think that's very interesting, I think a lot of people, especially those who are more intellectual.
Oh, yes.
Kristen.
Yes.
I think those who are more intellectual would include things like that on the list of what makes a person, quote unquote, sexy. Certainly, it's what makes a person interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, it's what makes a person generally appealing.
Mm-hmm.
But it bleeds over even into, as you just framed it, into being considered sexy. Yeah. So anyone out there who thinks they don't have a shot at being on that list one day, like let alone making it to the top, making it on the cover of People magazine, no less— being smart and funny
could be important
qualities.
I think so.
Making yourself appealing and even sexy.
I think that hits many people's wish lists, if
Very
you will.
Good. We appreciate it.
Well, and if you also do the dishes and take out the garbage.
That makes you really sexy.
There you go.
Let the kids to school.
Well, I take out the garbage.
All in.
There we go. You take out the garbage. How much garbage do you take out a week? Mark, you got to take out a lot of garbage to make the list. All right.
Okay.
Listen, guys, I want to go to, we mentioned we're going to talk about our cell phones these days. Now, are you familiar with the term cyborg? That's C-Y-B-O-R-G.
Okay.
Cyborg. If you look it up, it's a term that's been used in
science fiction.
Science fiction, right. Mm-hmm. Science fiction, exactly. And essentially, it's the thing of the Jetsons and all the rest, where one day in the future, there's going to be a being of some kind that is part man, part machine. The reality is Think about your life these days and the power of the cell phone, the mobile phone in your hand. I heard Elon Musk make a comment, I think it was roughly a year ago, and I think it might have been on one of Joe Rogan's podcasts or something to that effect, where he made the point, and it was so poignant, that he said that we already are cyborgs. Because think about it, a human being with a cell phone in their hand, if I said to you, how many, if you pick anything, I'm just picking this off the top of my head, how many species of whales are there? Well, in the absence of having what used to be the Encyclopedia
Britannica,
right, exactly,
yes.
You would not be able to answer that question.
That's right.
But with a cell phone in your hand, within 30 seconds, how many species of whales are there in the world? You'd be able to answer my question.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't come from your brain. Mm-hmm. That wasn't stored knowledge. That came from that device.
Right.
In your hand. You are a cyborg.
If we were on video right now, I would insert the mind blown emoji.
There you go. Right.
Because at the beginning of the show, we were talking about AI and how now it's turboed and it's going to be persuasive. And I'm a little nervous about that. And now you were talking about how basically we're all cyborgs because we're humans and we have our cell phones walking around in our hands. And I feel like I am part of a sci-fi movie right now.
Isn't that amazing? You're absolutely right, Kristen. That is the amazing thing about this. The future is here now, Kristen.
If the future's here now, Jeff, I'm going to wrap up this show. I'm heading out into my flying car.
Yes.
And I'm going home.
There you go. And with that, we're out of here. Kristen's going to fly home in her flying car. Fly carefully, Kristen. May the force be with you. And with that, we're going to call it a wrap for this Let's Go Michigan show. It's great to have you all with us and great to be here in the Great Lakes State in this beautiful autumn season here in the state of Michigan. All right, we'll be back again next week right here on Let's Go Michigan.
You can find more by our host, Jeff Sloan, on thegreatvoice.com, live on WJR Radio, 760 AM, and anywhere you listen to podcasts.